Welcome to Tech Theater Clubhouse Conversations, our last Clubhouse conversation before the holidays, but you're hearing it after the holidays. If you're new to us, we have conversations around conversations about the conversations we just had on the Clubhouse app.
This podcast continues that conversation. Every Tuesday on Clubhouse, we have amazing discussions with really, really brilliant people who sit at the intersection of technology and theater.
And we always walk away from those Clubhouse talks with so many thoughts, so we decided to share those and reach even more of our friends and collaborators through this here podcast. On that note, hey, I'm Jess, CEO and co-founder of Broadway Unlocked. My background's in the theater, and I love connecting it to technology and the internet and all that jazz. And today, for this recording, I'm coming to you from Austin, Texas.
And I'm Joe, co-founder of Broadway Unlocked. I've been building and operating startups for over 10 years now, so I try to bring a tech and media perspective to these conversations. And for this conversation, I'm coming to you from Phoenix, Arizona.
Pew, pew, pew. And today we are again joined by Joy Mary Blackwell.
Hi, I'm back. You can't get rid of me. I'm like COVID long haul. What's up? I'm joining you from Kansas City, Missouri. You're going to regret inviting me. I'm going to make you regret inviting me every week.
That's got to be the recurring bit. It's like, oh, and that's why we should have known better.
So our audio is all over the place because we're all in different places visiting friends and family for the holidays. Joe's in a closet somewhere in Arizona currently. Jermaine's in a very nice looking West Elm apartment.
This is the exact apartment that I take everywhere with me, so nobody knows. This is like a virtual background, so no matter where I'm at, I'm always at West Elm.
And I'm hiding in a house in the hills of Austin, alone with a very cute dog, happy to be safely tucked away from all the COVID craziness in New York City right now. Oh my God. All right, so we have tons to talk about today. This week on Clubhouse, we talked about two main stories that came up. The first was the current inconsistencies of COVID protocols across Broadway shows, and this particular article that the Broadway League sort of put down their foot and said, we're not shutting down Broadway amidst a lot of chaos and volatility. And we also started to talk about a new report that's out from Culture Track that details how audiences are seeking out the arts now compared to 2020. And I think that's the one I really want to get right into with y'all because we didn't have a ton of time to talk about it in Clubhouse today, but it feels incredibly relevant to everything we talk about here, the work we've been doing over the last 10 years to a point you made, Jermaine, in Clubhouse. And I know, like, y'all, it got Joe really jazzed because he's that data statistician, a nerd for that shit, and I cannot wait to hear what you have to say. Well, you are. Am I wrong?
Like, compared to between me and Jess, literally, yeah. Like, we don't know what numbers are.
I think you both said that on Clubhouse. You were like, I don't actually know how any of this works, but I think it's important.
I quite literally the other day did not add correctly to the number 29. Like, the math was not there. So let's just say I don't know data and statistics, but I will say that I did really enjoy, like, reading this study because, it, as I said in Clubhouse, it affirms the work that Jess and I did kind of in the early days of Broadway Unlocked in the Give Back concert particularly, but like the work that you and Jess and Joe continue to do with Broadway Unlocked and all together now as a brand of taking it online for people to enjoy. Do we want to talk a little bit more, I guess, like download what happened in this particular article, because we're talking about it and people haven't read it probably.
It's so true. Well, yeah, and I actually want to say, so I'll take a second to say, you can go to our Twitter to grab the link to read this report. And if you have anything to do with the arts as a patron, as a person who runs an arts institution, be sure to read this. I think it's really important. And I also just want to take a tiny second to shout out whoever made this report, because it's designed so well. And it's like bold and exciting and easy to digest for people like Jermaine and I who are like, can't add the number 29. What does this mean? So I just want to like give a little shout out to that because I was like, this is my jam. It is big numbers and big design all put together, and it made it a really fun experience to consume.
It is a good looking report. And I'm going to double down on that shout out to Hyperallergic, everyone's new favorite site that they didn't know existed until Lucy sent us this article. Which is where we originally found this report, which is the Culture and Community in a Time of Transformation. And it was conducted by LaPlaca Cohen and Slover Lynette Audience Research. And just like the quick overview, which I'm straight up reading from Hyperallergic now, is that the study examines people's experience of the cultural sector in the era of COVID-19. Unlike other culture-centered pandemic impact reports, it does not focus on a single group, such as artists or museum workers, but rather it focuses on the general public, which is what we thought was so cool about it. These are like real people telling you what they really think, not some museum curator or marketing department that's just kind of feeding you what they want you to think about their
or 65 sampled arts or institutions in an American theater definitive statement on the, oh, I'm sorry. Whoa, I'm backsliding. Go on. Never mind. Still mad about that.
Yeah, that one, we should have like a monthly segment of, hey, we're reading reports and commenting on them and linking back through all of them.
I'm waiting for the day that you guys mention that and somebody who like helped build that is like, wait a second. Like they like leave a comment on your like podcast, like Google Play.
Shout out, find this podcast on Google Play. Leave us a comment, even if you don't like what we have to say.
But I do actually tie back to that, Jess, of how that other study, that study that will not be named because I can't remember the name, like was poorly designed at the end of the day. It didn't survey a ton of people. This one really went for it. You know, I think there were 74,000 individual respondents that all were somehow associated or affiliated with, you know, 500 plus arts organizations. So it's like real people and a real huge, huge basis from which to collect this information. And they very specifically made an effort to provide statistically significant sampling of minority groups so that there was like research and data and information about these people. And they did that by a process called oversampling, in which, you know, the panel that they pull together of people, they make sure there's enough people in those underrepresented groups so that you can do all the fun math things and provide all the statistical analysis. Because, you know, if you were to only do like a representational amount of, I don't know, Native people, let's say, out of this 36,000 respondents that they talked to, you'd have like 13 people in the survey. So it's like, okay, that's not enough to actually do the math works. So that's what it means to do the oversampling.
I'm so excited for this chance for you to get very excited and show off all your nerdery, Joe. This is so great listening to you.
Make it like entertainment nerd, like so that I can still get it.
I'll throw down a little like soft stuff on it, which is like why I think stuff like this is super important. Because Jermaine, you were saying like this is stuff we've been thinking, saying for years and years and years and years, and like, it's really easy for people to like write you off as like, oh, you did it once in this one very specific city with this one very specific community. This doesn't apply to everyone. Like, no. And so like this sort of study and this sort of research, which does do it across like a greater breadth of people, locations, types of content, like it helps to like prove the point that y'all knew already just intuitively and through your own experience. And now it's sort of like an unimpeachable look at it, because I don't know, for better or worse, our culture has sort of started to hold up like data and statistics as like, oh, this is objective truth in a way that, you know, we struggle with all the time now. But that's why I think these things are so important, because it has become like a currency inside of those conversations about what is important, what deserves time, attention, money, and all those things. So for, you know, this group to do this research and to represent these people, to then have this tangible, very pretty report, is huge for us to have conversations, for us to go to our clients and, you know, push them on what things are important. Like it gives us that objective sort of proof behind it.
Yeah, and I wanted to start just with a little, because to Jermaine's point, I know what this means, because I think it's going to be Joe leading a lot of this conversation. But I did want to like point out in the first couple of pages, they sort of break down a lot of demographics and details about the people that were surveyed, which I thought was really interesting. I thought the first number that was really interesting is that only 13% or 68 organizations identified themselves as primarily serving a BIPOC community, which, as we like frequently talk on here, is both like amazing that they were able to sample. That's like a pretty big size. You know, I feel like they're overlooked. BIPOC communities are overlooked in studies for a number of reasons we've talked about a lot, but it's also like a very small number as well, right? Like both things are true. So I was really taken by that. I was particularly also taken by the fact that only 30% of these respondents had a formal arts affiliation, which kind of underlines what you were saying, Joe. Like these are real. We are real people too. Arts workers are real people. But we know when we try to learn what the future of the arts are, sometimes I think we have a tendency, like that American theater you know, survey to just like ask in the echo chamber. And this is really exciting that this survey touched a lot of people who enjoy the arts or go to the arts or think about the arts, but don't necessarily have a formal affiliation. And the last number, there's two more. Second to last number that I thought was interesting is that the average household income surveyed was $70,000, which felt huge. I was like, what the fuck? That's amazing. What the, and also arts, you know, patrons obviously are in a different socioeconomic strata than a lot of folks, which probably leads back to why only 13% of surveyed folks are BIPOC communities. And the last number that I thought was really interesting is that 17% of respondents reported having a disability, which reminded me of a lot of conversations we've had on here just about like, just because you don't see a group of people doesn't mean they're a minority, right? That there's like a lot of folks with disabilities, you know, communities of color, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just happy to see more of them represented in this.
I will also add real quick, and then Joe, please nerd out for us. Is that one of the numbers that I was kind of intrigued by was the spread of the operating budgets. And so like being kind of like it was kind of equal amongst like 2.5 million and below was similar, like the response rate was kind of similar to the over 20 million operating budget. And I just was kind of like, it was great to be able to see that, like, particularly where we, I mean, I don't necessarily think that we deal too much in $20 million operating budgets for the work that we do, but the idea that like, whether you have a lot of money in your budgets, in your operating budgets, or a little bit of money, like, what does this particular work look like for your particular, and what's the value, potential value add for your potential, for your organization, no matter what kind of money you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I also appreciate you too for taking what is historically an impossibly difficult task on a podcast, talking about numbers and actually making it interesting and enjoyable, which I actually do want to like put a, like make an explicit point to call out that like all of these numbers, like, there's human beings behind them, like we said, and they each have stories as to like what they confer and what this is all meant to sort of communicate. And so the like storytelling element of what I feel like you two both do incredibly well and definitely way better than I do. Like, I'm excited for this conversation to be sort of the intersection of our two worlds in that way. So maybe not tech and theater, but numbers and storytelling.
I do. I feel like we're making a WNYC podcast right now. I was listening to everybody and I was like, oh, this is like The Intercept or something. This is so exciting.
Also, I might be giving myself a lot of credit and you a lot of credit, Jess, but we sounded really smart in that moment. Like, when we were talking about these numbers, I was like, who do we think we are? Nerd for us, Joe. Nerd for us.
Where do you want to start, Joe?
I want to do a quick head nod to the like the top part of this survey, which was like, so this survey overall is about like culture and the arts, but they had like seven slides in this presentation that are just like, what up? We're just going to talk about COVID and how people feel about it. Yeah. I was like, that's just the reality of the world right now. And they're like, we're not going to pretend it's not. We're not going to shy past it. And they're just like, how are you feeling, everyone who we're surveying? How is this impacting you economically? And I don't think we need to dig into those numbers specifically, but just I want to acknowledge that that was like an important framing for how they set up their study of the disparate impacts of how COVID has affected different people in different communities in terms of income inequality and the, you know, loss of income across the time of the pandemic. And just like is a side of sort of the cultural institution element.
Yeah, and to that point, I found it very interesting that they quickly, this was like early, I think the first wave of their research was done like within like a month or maybe just a little bit over a month of COVID starting in America, like hitting America. Like COVID, like I think we shut down officially as a country basically March 13, 2020. I think they started their first wave like early April 2020. So they, like, whereas we were freaking out, I mean, I was freaking out and watching Rachel Maddow, they were just like, let's do a study about theater.
Yeah. Good for them. That's what they channeled their energies and their anxieties into. They're like, let's try and be productive right now.
I channeled mine better into Ruffles potato chips.
Everyone has their own path, right? I mean, to your point, Joe, though, it's so important. It makes me think of today's conversation on Clubhouse, where we like spent a ton of time talking about financials and economics of, you know, having to shut down every 2 weeks as an arts organization and all of these very tangible things. But like, when we got to the end of the conversation and Jermaine, you know, opened it up for everyone and said, does anyone have any last thing to add? What was the last thing that someone said? A person named Camera joined us today and said, I miss performing. I miss going to auditions. I miss the act of doing this thing that I am good at. And that is how we feel is a huge component, particularly for the arts, who has, I think, been really unfairly and unevenly impacted by COVID-19, as opposed to a lot of other industries. It's like you said, Joe, there's humans behind every single one of these numbers, right?
Yes, there are. Yeah. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, no, he didn't say that. Yeah, he definitely said that. No, but it's right. And it goes back to the work that we do and what we've, and what we knew at the beginning of the pandemic. I mean, theater obviously and performance spaces and art spaces were closed and have been closed for so long, and like you said, desperately impacted by this particular pandemic. But what did people turn to when they were locked into their homes? They turned into entertainment, and I think this kind of supports the work that we were able to do over the last year and a half, particularly when people, like, we could all go to Netflix, but what would happen for theater spaces and museums and stuff, like, outside of their spaces where people couldn't come to them? We brought those things to them. Yeah. And how people responded in kind to the work that organizations that we worked with and the organizations that we amplified through the work that we did. I don't know, I just think I think that it's important that we look at it this way, because I think so many organizations throw this away and think that, like, just because it seems hard or because they don't know how to do it, that it doesn't have any value to them, as opposed to leaning into the value, because these numbers and these responses show us that Joe is about to go over if we just shut the F up. but that this work is important outside of just Netflix or Hulu, or like this, like, there are theater companies that have just as important things to say and offer than Netflix and Hulu.
Yeah. Well, let's get on into it, because the meat of this report is about everything you're just saying, and they frame it through this concept of, like, our new hybrid normal, which, as you both know, you've been doing hybrid things for 10 years, pulling people together, blending audiences that are in person and then digitally extended or coming in via screens in some way. And, you know, we've known for a long time that this is a huge opportunity, and the pandemic just kind of catalyzed everyone else catching up and figuring that out. And, you know, overcorrecting a little, and everyone was on screens purely for, you know what, two years almost now. And now we're sort of like flexing backward into this combination of, okay, some things are great in person, some things are actually better digitally. And that's what this report really tried to get into, is what were people thinking and feeling? And I do want to just call out, Jermaine, to your point from before, they surveyed people in April of 2021. So it was like right as vaccinations were becoming a bit more accessible for Americans. Just for context around some of these responses, because I actually think that plays in for a few of them, which is cool. So one place I wanted to go to was, if you all are looking at this with me, it's the slide that's called Activating the Digital Realm, of just like what actually drove people to actually go do things and like what they took away from it. And as they were thinking about the different sort of online arts and cultural activities, sort of how do they rank and decide what to do based on you know, what they had access to. And the thing at the end of the day, which is like just true of the internet, is free was sort of the key. Mm-hmm. And I was curious what y'all thought of that, of like, oh, is that actually, you know, free? Is free going to be the only way that people consume? And if not, like, why? What is going to drive someone to actually pay for something digitally? And if they do pay for it, why are they going to come back? What is going to make them want to stay for that thing and then come back and do it again?
That's like the area that I'm most fascinated to like see answers reveal themselves on, right? Because I think that is a huge question mark. My instinct for me says, at least for the arts, there's going to be a mirror to the same thing that happened with film and TV, right? Which is, there's a small swath of free things, well, small comparatively because it's the internet, but there's the medium things, right? The medium cost things, like, which are streaming platforms and movie rentals on iTunes. And then there's the expensive thing, right? Which theoretically, in this case, I guess, is like your cable package or going to see a full movie in a theater that's now like $25. So that's my instinct. But I feel like this is a big question mark. And I'm just, I'm really curious to see how this shakes out.
Yeah, page 20, a couple pages after the page that you're talking about, Joe is breaking the paywall. And it made me think about, like, there's theater companies, and where I'm speaking specifically about theater, not necessarily like museums and other arts institutions, but like people, right? The field of dreams, if you build it, they will come, right? And so I feel like arts organizations are figuring out different things, like that we've worked with, right? Of, we already have this grant money, so can we provide this thing to the community for free? Like, mm-hmm. Hey, we can't meet in this particular time. And so as a kind of payback while we're waiting till we are able to get back to the theater again, here are these offerings that we have for you until we can meet again, right? And then there's like that conversation about like organizations that are smaller, probably those less than 2.5 million, less than 1 million, with operating budgets who are using it as fundraisers. And there are some like with huge budgets that are using it as fundraisers as well too, right? But I think like when I look at this breaking the payroll page 20, I'm thinking about like, I feel like there are obviously, if you're able to pay for something, like interest and excitement, which like made up 58% of like what people like were looking at, like if they would like pay or not, like, or if they would attend something or not, like if they were excited to see something, if it was something that like sparked their like interest, pay for that.
Do you think people on OnlyFans count in that category?
Oh, totally. I think that like, I've said plenty of times before that I do think that there's a world in which we need to host, like, maybe not OnlyFans, but I think that's a great idea that you said that. But, but I do think that like, the Bachelor Nation people, like, I don't watch that show, but people love that, and like I feel like there's interest there. And this isn't, I just want to preface it, like, The Bachelor is not art, but these are not the art organizations that we are talking about, but I think of like Bravo, and I think of like The Bachelor, and like that kind of thing, people would pay to come and do those things because it's interesting to them. But I also think like one of the things that's going to get people to come, you know, when we talk about like the people responding and saying like it being free to them is what they would prefer, I do think that quality is another deciding factor in like if someone's going to like, right, like if it's just someone on Zoom, more than likely it'll be like a pay what you can or donate situation, because the quality is not going to be as high as like as if you do something with Broadway Outlaw and All Together Now. That wasn't a pitch until that moment.
I have this weird thought that I love from the combination of these two pages we're talking about. And just if you're listening at home and not looking at this, the breaking the paywall page that Jermaine's referencing says that 58% of respondents paid for an online activity did it because of their interest or excitement about the content or the artist who made the content. And like, those that paid for an online activity because they were supporting an arts or culture organization is the lowest percentage of people, right? And what that makes me think of, that both of you know about, is like, and this sounds so rudimentary now, but 10 years ago, right, when I was like, oh, we should open the door digitally to these things that we're doing in person, my next thought off of that, as I talked about a lot, was like, at the time, was like, right, so if you give the Andrew Keenan Bulgers of the world, who at the time was in Newsies and was making a lot of video, he was really the first theater person making a ton of video content on YouTube, like connect him to the Newsies tour and give people the chance to watch all his content and get to know him and get really passionate about him. And they're much more likely to show up for like the tour of Newsies, right? Or like a special event or a signing because you got to know Andrew or any one of the, I used to talk about a lot at that time, ensemble members of Newsies, for instance, who were like, you're usually fairly, you know, invisible as an ensemble member. You're usually not a breakout star, but like plenty of them were making really great content on the internet. And so there's a piece of this that I don't think is solved yet, but if this is telling us that people will pay because they're excited about the content or the artist, there's kind of a model flip somewhere opportunity here where the individual performers inside, in particular, let's just talk Broadway because we know it the best, inside the Broadway show all of a sudden have more agency and value because they are the thing that really drives paying for like the stream of Clydes, right? Like, it's not really watching Clyde's to support Second Stage or to go to Broadway at Second Stage. It's because you, I don't know, something's, you're doing something digitally with Uzo or Ron or any of the young actors that are in the show.
Or even just as basic as, as we know from that first year or two of the Get Back concert and your point about Andrew Keenan Bolger, like in the situation with Clyde's, right? It's, oh, I know Uzo Aduba. I don't know Clyde's. I don't know Second Stage. Right. I know Uzo Aduba, so I'm going to show up for her.
Right.
Yeah, I actually just learned a term earlier today called a micro-influencer, which, mm-hmm. you know, I think Uzo is more than a micro-influencer, but yeah. it's the idea that there's a bunch of influencers out there with like lots of followers, but they're in a very specific and you know, smaller niche. Is it niche or niche?
Niche?
I don't know what I said.
Is it gala or gala?
Like... Exactly. Well, we'll record it both ways and Lucy will just pick. But that they're in like a very specific niche and they have like greater engagement because people feel closer, more closely connected to them yeah. rather than like that, you know, one person who has 10 million followers on Instagram or Twitter or wherever. And this feels similar to that, where it's allow someone to build up a close community without the need to become the biggest thing in the world, because you have that closer connection and you actually are helping to, yeah, whatever it is, drive sales or monetize what you're doing somehow differently, so you don't have to play that race to just be the biggest and chase the ad dollars a la, you know, the YouTube business model and other sort of ad-based revenue models. So I'm into the idea of micro-influencer, and I'm excited to read more about it. But it feels connected to this of people caring about and justifying spending for things on the internet because they care about some human or some personality on the internet that specifically appeals to them, but they also feel close enough to like justify that money, because it's not just going out into the ether to some huge company, but rather you at least feel, and it probably is, your ticket is going to this person.
Mm-hmm. And to that point,
like a Patreon or something.
Right, and to that point, right, like I think that this summed up or kind of supported by, I think it's slide number 19 maybe, which is just straight from the source, right, which we're talking about, like the biggest, the question was, who provided the online arts and culture activities that you did? And the overwhelming response was individual artists or performers, right? Like, and like one of the smaller responses was the actual Performing Arts Center.
Yeah.
Like they're not going there to like support like Second Stage, like we were saying, they're going there to support Uzo Aduba, or whoever the writer is.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It makes me question like, what is now the role of a performing arts center or museum, or I'm just reading off this slide now and I was going to say library, but I still get what a library does. That's important. But does the role of these organizations, which, you know, have historically been curatory, you know, they tell us, the adoring public, what we should be paying attention to. But now we are starting to tell them what we want and who we care about and who they should feature or support or sort of pull into their resources to do more different cool things. So I'm curious how like a performing arts center might adapt in this future world as, yeah, live streaming becomes more of a thing. Can they help sort of amplify the artists or the individual performers that we care about and not necessarily need to be pushing things or people on us?
Which I feel like organizations know that, right? Because that's why so many organizations, community theaters, do Annie every 4 years. Right? Or, you know what I mean? Like, you look yeah. at like seasons and you look at Broadway. Like, last time I joined you all, Broadway, Red Lobster at Broadway, like, right? Like, I talked about, I used Shrek as that avatar. Is like, they didn't come to Broadway to see Brian D'Arcy James play Shrek. They just knew Shrek. Like, right. Who Shrek was. And so that was basically, if you said individual artist or performer or like content or property, right? Like that's what people, I feel like, respond to more than like just being like, I just really want to support this particular dance company.
Yeah.
I would love to take us a little different direction if y'all are down for a slight transition.
Let's do it. Yeah.
I wanted to call heavy attention to something that we say all the time, but especially during the pandemic, that we more than anyone, or I guess as much as anyone, we're really excited about the world coming back where we could do things in person and we could approach this sort of hybrid world of in-person experiences and digital experiences. And this report doesn't shy away from it either. It talks about people want to go back in person. They want to do things in person. And I think that's super important. But with it has also come a few places, a few things that people are like, oh, actually, I want to be able to tune into a movie from my couch or see a live Broadway show from my apartment with a group of my friends. And that like those more specific use cases are going to continue to hold on now that in-person things are coming back, and that it isn't just a captive audience of people stuck in their homes, and whatever we can put on a screen for them is enough. I like that it's going the direction of, no, now we have to do this well. We have to do this the best version. We have to be really thoughtful about the experience because we no longer have that captive audience. I was curious what y'all are thinking about that.
I just keep thinking about when, like, we get talking about stuff like this, and this maybe is just like a little swing, but I think it's related that all of this surveying is, what I think is so interesting is that all of this surveying can't help but be through the lens of our experience in COVID, right? To the point of this particular survey, which is in person was taken away from us. Like, my opinion is informed by, not mine actually, because we've been doing this other work for 10 years. So pretend I'm someone else today that didn't even know that you could make things hybrid. I got in person taken away. My only access to things of the world was digital. I didn't hate it so bad. But now, like, I can go back in person 3 months ago. Holy shit. Can't wait. Go in. See you later. Then a little bit of time to think. And I'm like, well, some stuff I liked, you know what I mean? But I'm still not that, or this person that we're talking about who we're surveying right now, and the lens through which we're talking about what we think that we need to do for the future is not the ultimate, like, audience, like the end audience for digital. Like, we haven't even scratched the surface, right, of what happens when this stuff is good enough, to your point, Joe, to be such an engaging experience that there's a whole new audience that's truly just built similar to kids watching YouTube, you know, 15 years ago when it first came out. That's just for watching live digital stuff. Does that make sense? I'm like so excited about that.
It's a whole untapped world. It's sort of the beauty is in what we don't know yet.
Yeah.
And there's so many cool, interesting potential things that'll happen just because the foundation has now been set. Like, people have enough technology and have enough of a need or a desire to do things digitally that there's going to be experimentation. There's going to be risk-taking because it has been proven out a bit. And like this report sort of tells you is that there is an appetite that continues to exist for it, even as people go back in person, to justify spending the money, to justify the Ratatouille musical, wherever that's going next. I want that to come back. I've had this thought like multiple times across the past few weeks of like, I hope that comes back in some substantial way that I can go enjoy somewhere.
I'm sure it'll pop up somewhere, like on Torrent or something. Is that still a thing?
BitTorrent. Pirate Bay.
Something like that. Napster. But like, one of the, to that point, you know, I've said this before about like a theater that I worked at in the past, and I'm like, your subscriber base is dying off. Like, what are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do? And I really do think that like, if this pandemic, and I've said this in Clubhouse plenty of times, but if this pandemic has proven anything to us or proved anything to us, is that people, I mean, right, like this particular survey was done in two different waves, April of 2020 and then April of 2021, right? The numbers change, like rise to like people's kind of more desperation or whatever when we go through waves. Well, like their need for like arts and stuff when you hit wave two, when you hit 2021, because they've been so starved of it. If you look at like early April, when I'm saying when we're first going through this pandemic, the world just shuts down in March of 2020. Oh, we all thought we were going to be back. We're going to flatten the curve and we're going to be back in 2 weeks. And like, we're not going to be concerned about this, right? And so you look by wave two, people are more kind of like responding to this survey and more kind of thirsty for this thing. And I do think that to the points that I think that you and Joe are also making is something that we need to address is that, yes, people's subscriber bases, whether are dying off, whether because of age, whether because we are living through a pandemic right now, and it's going to take a while for people to want to come back to the theater, even if they are alive. Like for me to like go and sit in the Met, like it was a lot for me because I was just like, I've been isolated. Like the last thing you want to do in a global pandemic where you can die from respiratory droplets and like people coughing on you is go sit in a room with opera singers singing their COVID bullets at you. And then people, like 2,000 people in an opera hall, and we're all masked and we're supposedly all vaccinated, right? But like there are people who will not be coming back to the theater for a while. And so they've lost their audiences. So like you build, whether like they're dying off, you build a new audience with this virtual offerings. Like I really do feel like this is the way to start trying to build your new group, like build or maintain your audience so that when we can meet together again in a more safer situation and when people want to like join us again, or when I want to join you again, like you have been keeping them warm with your virtual offerings.
I'm really hopeful on that point, and I hadn't thought about this, that because the Clyde's live stream, which if for some reason this is the first time you're tuning into the podcast, Second Stage on Broadway, one of four nonprofit theaters that operate in a Broadway house, is running a play called, a Lynn Nottage play called Clyde's, and they're going to live stream the last 2 weeks of it. I'm actually doing the original camera blocking for it. And because they're a nonprofit, I wonder if, and I hope so badly, that they will break down their digital audiences in a report afterwards, as opposed to right Broadway, who we all know will hide all of their ticket information till the end of days, because that's going to be fascinating.
Let's get that Freedom of Information application going.
Oh my god!
That to the government.
Oh, I want to do it. I want to do it so bad.
Yeah. I don't actually know if those apply to non-profit or not-for-profit organizations, or if they're only for government institutions. But I think it's worth looking into.
That's good.
I mean, to that point a bit, and I think a lot of what this this report gets into, it wants to like really position these people as the guiding force for what we take risks on, what we experiment in. And the bottom part of this report gets into this section called Visions of Transformation, which I quite liked, that word. But it got into like what these respondents like think matters most and what they want from their arts organizations. And the top response there was that they want their arts organizations to think about, to talk about, to be proactive in systemic racial injustices and income inequality. And a lot of these places that I do think a lot of arts organizations do talk and focus around, but I wonder if this sort of information and these sorts of requests from the people who are going to be consuming the content or consuming the sort of outputs of these arts organizations, if these organizations will sort of like take that in hand and go even further with these.
I hope so. I mean, you know, I mentioned the pot, you know, every week in the Clubhouse, I mention a Black creative, and this week I mentioned basically all the Black creatives of the last year who have kind of mentioned like artistic spaces in which they've worked that have been kind of harmful to creators of color, just because I think that it's one thing to say we're going to be more proactive about presenting and producing work that is by creators of color or other marginalized groups, and doing the work to also address your own internal systems and disrupting those and making sure that there's like equity and not harm there. And what we're learning, right? I mean, even on like as something as little as, everybody knows I'm a fan of Bravo, but on Project Runway, like they have all of these Black designers and brown designers now, but there are still certain things that I'm watching as the season progresses, like that the producers are obviously learning, like, oh, not that we don't only have one Black person here, we have to be very cognizant of how we deal with our models, and that they're like with people of color who are designers, that they are designing for their own communities and like with their own kind of lens, right? And I think that like it's great to do all of this work, but I think we also to make sure, because we need it, but we also have to look at our audiences who like to say that they're ready for this work until it's presented to them, and then they feel guilty and they're just like, well, let's just go back to Kill a Mockingbird where we can feel happy again. You know,
your,
what I mean?
Your favorite example, The Music Man, which started previews this week.
Yikes. But yeah, it's just one of those things that like, it's fantastic that like we have the ear and people are interested in these things, but it goes beyond just putting it on the stage. There are so many different things that happen within the audience, within production, within organizational structures that are not supportive of the numbers that we see in this study. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Lucy, I hope that you can, as we're sort of running out of time, I hope that we can find these folks that did this report and tag them on Twitter when this episode comes out and hopefully start a conversation with them, because I just think, again, especially after this conversation we've had today, that this report was really well done. It's really important. I would like to hear them and Joe, you talk to them through all of this great nerd shit.
Yeah, they are like the actual smart ones, so that'll be even more fun.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think this is one of my very favorite conversations we've ever had on this podcast, actually, and the subject of this report is why, right? And it was really cool. So thank you for coming and joining us, Jermaine.
Thanks. I also want to real quick say that I also appreciate when we're talking about these people, the people who did this survey, like a lot of times in these kind of surveys, I feel like in like conversations about theater or anything racial, things are very binary or maybe even tertiary. I don't know what the threesome of a binary is, but the idea that like we talk about like black, white, and then either Asian or black, white, and like Latinx, Latin, Hispanic, and I appreciate. I also really appreciate that they that first world of Native American peoples were included in this, because I do think like it actually made me think about certain things, particularly like museums and other arts organizations, how they are represented, because they are so often underrepresented in these kind of numbers. So thank you for having me. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that out there, but thank you for having me. It's always great to be here. And this was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Jermaine. And for everyone, go check out the Culture and Community research report in a Time of Transformation. And like we said earlier, it's from La Placa Cohen and Slover Lynette Audience Research. Once you have a chance to read it, and hopefully you've just been following along, because otherwise you might be a little lost. you should tell us what you think about it. You can join us on Twitter at BWY Unlocked and use the hashtag TechTheaterCH and share your thoughts.
And of course, come join our next conversation on Clubhouse Tuesday at 12:55 Eastern. Raise your hand, jump in, and share your thoughts.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, mostly because Jermaine was here, but whatever, we'll take the 5 stars. Go to Apple Podcasts, leave the review, give us the stars.
So
give
aggressive.
Them the stars. Give them the stars. My precious.
The stars. Give us the stars.
Give us the stars, saying, you know,
catch me sometimes. Oh, man. So as you all know, every single topic we talk about each week is inspired by the articles we read and share in our company Slack channel and the people who join our stage. So we're looking forward to having you in the clubhouse, seeing you on the tweets, and thanking you for your nice reviews. See you next week, y'all.
Bye, everyone.
See you in the stars. Bye.